Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, y'all. Scott Horton Show. I'm him. ScottHorton.org, etc. like that. Introducing Greg Mello. He is the executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group and an expert on nuclear weapons. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Greg?
Good morning, Scott. I'm fine.
Good. Very happy to have you on the show here. So tell me, they're holding a nuclear security summit. That must be a big party where they celebrate spending trillions of dollars more on nuclear weapons. Is that right?
Yeah. No, it's an international confab with world leaders gathered to talk about nuclear terrorism mostly, with side conversations on issues of mutual interest.
But still alcohol and strippers and stuff, though.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So it is kind of a party, but where they pretend to be concerned about nukes rather than just in the nuclear weapons business. I see.
Yeah, something like that. Mm-hmm.
And, well, as far as that goes, how much of a problem are the so-called loose nukes? Are there really any loose nukes from the old USSR, or is it really much of a danger, you think, that a kook like Ayman al-Zawahiri could get his hands on the ability to split some atoms?
Well, I don't think there are any loose nuclear weapons. There is, I think probably one of the bigger concerns is U.S. nuclear weapons in Europe. There's activists broke into a nuclear weapons bunker in Belgium, for example, and just kind of sat there, took videos, and because no one wants to really invest in the security of those nuclear weapons, because that's very expensive, and Belgium has issues of integrity of the state and so forth, as you know we all do. But maybe a little more in Belgium. So nuclear weapons. I don't think that there's a big risk of nuclear weapons per se running loose. There could be a higher risk for nuclear sources, like are used for hospital sterilization or for geological disposal. It could become a dirty bomb. Then there's nuclear power plants, which I, scanning over the material produced by the administration, I see that they're kind of downplaying that risk. But in fact, all nuclear power plants are vulnerable to insider risks, and the spent fuel pools are extremely dangerous. So they're, you know, nuclear technologies as a whole have inherent problems, especially where there's a huge amount of nuclear material gathered in one place, and you need hundreds of people to operate them. It's difficult to vet everyone perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think it occurred to a lot of people after September 11th that if they hadn't decided on symbolic targets like the towers and the Pentagon and I guess the White House or the Capitol, whichever the fourth plane was meant to hit, and they had all just decided to suicide bomb those planes into nuclear reactors around the country, all of which are available on Google Maps, or I guess at that time on your Mapsco map, that they certainly could have done a hell of a lot of damage. They were all just wide open targets from the air as far as that goes, right?
Yes. There was a debate after that, after 9/11 and before, about whether commercial aircraft would penetrate the containment domes at these reactors, but I think that the answer is that they would. The shafts of jet engines are very heavy, strong objects, and they would penetrate.
Well, and even the fuselage of the plane, even though it's and I don't know how thick a concrete we're really talking about here, but even though it's aluminum, still aluminum pretty thick and going hundreds and hundreds of miles an hour, and not just a leading edge like a plane, but the fuselage keeps coming and coming and coming. So
yes, that's
you can see it do more and more damage, you know, as it crashes, that kind of deal, instead of just squinching up like a cigarette butt or what.
And we've learned, I think, if we didn't know before, from Fukushima, that loss of power, loss of control of various systems at the nuclear power plants can lead to catastrophic meltdowns.
All right, now, I'm no nuclear physicist, but I'm friends with one. And his expertise, Gordon Prather, his expertise was making H-bombs. And so this wasn't his area of expertise, but I've heard him use to me before that it seems kind of a mystery that in the 2010s that we can't just go somehow from nuclear energy straight to electricity and skip the heat and the steam and all that at this point. Work along those lines had been done for so long and whatever, and I remember him kind of remarking that he thought all these nuclear reactors seemed really primitive and that, you know, things could be done in a way that does not require this much dangerous waste, et cetera, et cetera. What do you think of that?
Well, it's a positive dream, you might say, but it is still just that. There isn't any way to produce large-scale nuclear electricity without heat and waste and a nuclear fuel cycle, which is vulnerable to proliferation and all the rest.
Yeah. Well, and of course, as we saw with the Fukushima thing, the fact that they even have nuclear reactors in a place like Japan on the Ring of Fire is just, you know, how bad does the average nuclear plant have to be shaken for, you know, as you said, major systems to fail, which is enough.
Right. I think that some of the workers in Fukushima Unit Number 1, before they saw the plant failing and were told to get out before the tsunami hit, just because of the earthquake, because pipes were off the walls and systems were failing. So it's an error-prone technology, and to prevent those problems is very expensive. So, you know, if you don't get it one way, you get it another way. It's a problem.
Yeah. All right, so now back to the weapons, because that's the real big deal here. I actually just saw recently the documentary, The Man Who Saved the World, where the Soviet officer who refused to believe his computer that warned that America had launched a first strike back in, was it 1981, I guess, whatever. But they show him on a tour of the Minuteman missile silos in, I guess, North Dakota or South Dakota or something. And he's explaining, the tour guide is explaining that the Minuteman missiles that they had there, at, I think he said, one megaton, that was as much as all of the bombs dropped, or more. That was, I know what it was. That was 40% more than all the bombs dropped in World War II combined, including Hiroshima and Nagasaki nukes. That's how much a megaton is that we're talking about when Hiroshima was 10 kilotons. And we know that the United States has thousands and thousands and thousands of these things, these H-bombs that are in the megaton range. And it's been reported here and there. I don't know the exact, you know, expert source on it, but I've read this repeatedly from time to time about how the bureaucracy between the missile launch department, the submarines, you know, under the control of the Navy, the air bombers, how they all claim priority over the different targets, to where I was just reading recently there is a radar station or some small command headquarters in the suburbs of Moscow that's on the list to be nuked 67 times or something like that in a row because of all the different nuke agencies angling for their shot too, whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of thing, if that sounds like it couldn't possibly be true, seems to, you know, kind of really be true. And as you said about the security in Belgium, it's not in anybody's interest to pay too much mind to it, they don't think. And it sort of seems like the same thing with our entire nuclear weapons policy. We got hardcore critics like you and the Quakers and then crickets. Right? I mean,
yes.
Is anybody trying
like
to undo this stuff at all, or what?
Well, there are, and let's go back through this. So what the situation you described about the size of the warheads and the number of warheads on the target, that was more characteristic of the Cold War. But if we were to divide, let's say, divide that ICBM yield by, let's say, half or a third, it really doesn't change much. And take that 67 warheads on a target and divide that by something, it doesn't change that. We have thousands of nuclear weapons ready to launch. We have about 7,000 intact nuclear weapons in the stockpile and in a dismantlement queue, which is moving very slowly and which the administration does dip into and exchanges weapons back and forth. So the question of how real is that dismantlement queue is also with us. The Russians, about the same. So there hasn't been, in terms of the effects of nuclear weapons, there hasn't been that much change. Because if nuclear weapons are detonated, it only takes a few to destroy a country. It only takes a few hundred, let's say, to create a nuclear winter, which is universally fatal. So, I mean, we're way over the universally fatal threshold. Our war plans are basically all just suicidal. So, in terms of effects, nothing has changed. There are critics in the arms control community, very smart people, who would like to trim the aggressiveness of the massive modernization plan that we have now in place. So, I think that should be supported and mentioned. So, for example, the United States is planning to build more than 1,000 stealthy nuclear-tipped cruise missiles in the 2020, against which there is no defense, no realistic defense. And the military is really thrilled about this. They think this is the greatest thing. Now, of course, that just means that there'll be more offense. So we're back, really, at the end of Obama's presidency, we're back in a major arms race. This country's planning to spend more than $1 trillion on nuclear modernization, which means upgrading, designing and building new kinds of warheads, new kinds of weapons. It just came out this week that an old Reagan idea for moving ICBMs around is now the preferred option of this administration. So, you know, we're back in some ways, we're back in the Reagan era. And because the president and his people seem unable to provide any kind of leadership in this field.
Yeah, or all too much leadership in the wrong direction anyway.
Yeah, there we go.
And now, so here's the thing too, though, about, and this is kind of confusing to me when something is so obvious to me that I just can't believe that this is the policy, and yet it's every day one way or the other, one subject or another. You put nuclear warheads on cruise missiles. That means anytime you launch a cruise missile at anyone, their military command is more likely than not to go ahead and bet that that missile, more likely than not, is a nuke. And then these same people are the same ones who just a couple of years ago, and maybe they're still following through with this, we're talking about, hey, I know, let's put conventional bombs on 3-stage intercontinental ballistic missiles, which, again, same thing again. You're just making it where, oh, gee,
right,
all we were doing was launching a 500-pound bomb to kill one family, and oops, we got Los Angeles nuked because
right,
our adversaries thought we were coming at them with an H-bomb.
This is a very important point you raised there, and it has been raised by former Secretary of Defense William Perry, who used to be a big cruise missile fan, Andrew Weber, who was a top official in the Pentagon under Obama until the neocons maneuvered to get him fired, and he was blocking this missile, and now he's not. So it's going forward, and this ambiguity is absolutely nuts. It is really nuts, and it shows the nuclear warfighting mentality, which has crept back into the Pentagon, into the STRATCOM, and, of course, into the weapons laboratories, where it probably never left, which is something that by the end of the Cold War, there was a reluctant admission that, you know, we just can't fight a nuclear war. But now it's back.
Absolutely crazy. And correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't I just read a quote from Ashton Carter, the Secretary of Defense, saying just that in completely unembarrassed terms that, you know, yeah, with these dial-a-yield tactical nuclear weapons, it makes them much more usable. And it wasn't a warning. It was a sales pitch, I think.
Yes, that's right. You did read that. I can't remember where, but I'm pretty sure you did read it.
Jesus. I mean, yeah, it was just a couple of days ago, and I thought, well, he must be putting on his pretend gray beard for a second, and he's warning us about what we're doing, right? No, apparently not.
No. Because the theory is, you know, the nutball theory, straight from Dr. Strangelove, is that for the deterrent to be credible, it has to be usable. So the more we talk about the usability of nuclear weapons and the practicality of conducting nuclear war, then the safer we are, right?
I guess so.
Yeah.
Hey, you know what? As long as I have you here, let me ask you, well, I got a couple more things if you got time.
Sure.
First of all, could you just teach us a little bit about how the nuclear weapons lobby works? Because, you know, I've been interested in the economics of politics and the special interests and how they get their ways, no matter which special interests we're talking about, for a very long time. And yet, it's still, I had this magical thinking about nuclear weapons that this is really a demand-oriented business, and that when the government needs nukes, they go to the nuke makers and get them. But the idea that this is really a supply-side industry, just like Lockheed with the fighter jets, that you have people basically pushing, you know, people in private industry and I guess in the government, pushing nukes on the military more than they even want them necessarily, and this kind of thing, just as you would have with any other special interest lobby, it just never occurred to me that it could really be that way when we're talking about H-bombs. And yet,
yes.
I think I've been disappointed to learn that I was really naive.
Well, I think you described it pretty well, and any of us can only see part of this big elephant, but here goes. The nuclear weapons business is almost completely privatized. So there are commercial interests, and then there are ideologues, and they are located in the military now, as well as in Congress and in what you might call the deep state, which the graybeards, which are very influential in think tanks and as individuals and on boards of corporations. Commercial interests. So the Department of Energy, for example, that makes the warheads, they have a subsidiary called the National Nuclear Security Administration that actually is the part of DOE that makes the warheads. It's about 97% privatized. So companies like Bechtel, they changed their names. AECOM, URS, University of California, they are all involved. Fluor Corporation, Lockheed Martin, they're all involved in this business, and they form a kind of cabal. Another feature is that they put their staff people into place inside Congress and inside executive agencies. Sometimes they're on change of station assignment, so they're actually being paid by Bechtel, let's say, and they're making policy in the Department of Energy or in the Pentagon. Or they may be sort of laundered after they leave, say, a weapons laboratory, and they get sit out for 6 months or whatever the required amount of time is, and then they appear in a new guise as a senior staff member of the House Armed Services Committee. And there they play an outsized role in determining policy because the members are extremely busy raising money and so forth, so the staff really do most of the thinking. It's an enterprise. It has its ideological and its economic and its political component. The political component is oriented around pork barrel politics. Our state in here in New Mexico is conceives of itself as a dependent, a vassal state, which requires its senators to promote nuclear weapons at every opportunity.
Yeah, it's really something else. And of course, why would it be any other way? How could it possibly be any other way? It only takes the, you know, you just have to stop and consider it for a minute. That, of course, that's got to be how it is. Just the same as, you know, the guy, the company with the contract to sell tube socks to the Pentagon. They got millions of dollars at stake. Think they're not going to spend thousands lobbying to make sure they keep their millions? You know, same with anything. So, yep, same with the H-bombs. Makes perfect sense. As insane as it sounds. But now, so what about the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which the Senate ratified and which says we promise to get rid of our nukes? Is that just completely a dead letter at this point?
Well, yeah, it is, as that's you've just described Article 6 of the treaty, which, yes, we did ratify, and it is part of the highest law of the land, and we don't pay any attention to it. We have to pay, I guess, in international gatherings, we have to make some kind of noise about our future, distant future ambitions to get rid of nuclear weapons, but it's all just smoke. Meanwhile, we're blocking every possible avenue that would lead to that. And, yeah, so the NPT has the U.S. and other nuclear weapon states have created a lot of tension in the non-proliferation community by this type of hypocrisy, and we seem comfortable with a kind of nuclear apartheid world, and it's not comfortable to everybody, certainly not in the Middle East, because of Israel's nuclear arsenal especially, and it leads to a lot. Some countries have decided that, North Korea, for example, that they will be safer with nuclear weapons than without. So, no, it's not a stable situation.
Yeah. Hey, it just came up in my last interview that Andrew Coburn had written this great piece for Harper's called Game On, and it was about how all the military-industrial complex types in D.C. were celebrating the advent of the new Cold War with Russia that Obama's helped gin up here. And I was just wondering if you hear talk like that in New Mexico, where people are really excited about the brave new future where we get to, you know, make even more weapons. Did you hear about the bad news about our relationship with Russia? Because I like stuff like that, you know, the out of the mouths of babes kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. I haven't personally heard that sort of talk in its baldest form, but there, every time there is discussion of more money, and sometimes that is connected with renewed, let's see, there's the obligatory bashing of Russia and Putin to justify it. There's rejoicing, yes. More money for the labs, more money for the Air Force. We have to have this because of Russian aggression. And definitely there's a triumphalist, you know, our lobbying will be more successful now. That's the sort of tone of it. And it is extremely deplorable, as much as it is completely false as far as the demonization goes.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's the whole last interview there. All right. Well, listen, I really appreciate your time on the show. Was there anything important about the Nuclear Security Summit that I should have asked you that I didn't get around to?
Oh, gosh. Well, perhaps only this, that, you know, that the U.S. government has its purposes in hosting the summit, and some of them are good, you know, and some of them are hidden. Maybe good. Maybe it's good to talk to between Obama and Erdogan of Turkey. Maybe that's just an absolute good, and maybe they need a cover of a nuclear security summit to have that conversation. But what is particularly hard to swallow is that the U.S. NGO and nonprofit community has allowed itself to be engineered into a kind of cheering section that is not asking difficult questions and not holding the administration to account, or is doing so only at to a minor degree and at a very late date. and so is ineffectual. We are not making progress on these issues, in part because the community of dissent, which used to be vibrant, is now more and more composed of what has been called excellent sheep. And so the public does not see dissent, and nobody, it's very difficult, except places like your show, to punch through the layers of dissembling.
All right, y'all, that is Greg Mello. You can find him at LASG.org. That's the Los Alamos Study Group, LASG.org. Boy, which proves you guys got that URL way back in the day when URLs were a brand new thing, LASG.org. That's great. And expert on nukes and opponent of them. Thanks very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott.
Hey, all, Scott here. On average, how much do you think these interviews are worth to you? Of course, I've never charged for my archives in a dozen years of doing this, and I'm not about to start. But at patreon.com/ScottWhartonShow, you can name your own price to help support and make sure there's still new interviews to give away. So what do you think? 2 bits? A buck and a half? There are usually about 80 interviews per month, I guess, so take that into account. You can also cap the amount you'd be willing to spend in case things get out of hand around here. That's patreon.com/ScottWhartonShow. And thanks, y'all.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. And I host 2 shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday, and The Future of Freedom with FFF founder and president Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org.